You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 276, Exodus 14, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's a scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Well, I'm sitting here, my as we record this, my last day at Faith Life, so my office is basically empty.
Did they throw you a
even
party?
Even the portraits of Maury have been packed away.
Yeah. Are you sad? Are you happy? Are you excited?
Oh, I'm excited about what's adventure. Next. Yeah.
Did no, they throw I'm you good. A party? Give you a cupcake? Do they give you a card?
No.
Do they do anything? No.
No. They know better than that.
Peace. Well, you've been recording.
They know
stuff.
Better than that.
Can you talk about any of the final projects you've done with them as far as recording wise or anything? Can you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yesterday I sent out, I think my wife did too on Instagram. And I guess Faith Life did too. But we recorded. The last thing I did was record what are going to be small group videos or 4 or 5 minutes a shot, sort of introducing each chapter of the book that will come out in October, called The World Turned Upside Down, Finding the Gospel in Stranger Things, the TV show Stranger Things. So I'm a real fan of the show, and it's really easy to look at that show and see how it taps into big archetypal themes and the human condition and whatnot, and map that over to the story, the meta-narrative of scripture, meta-narrative of the gospel, salvation history. So that's what that book aims to do. It's aimed at, it's going to be youth groups a lot, but then you have people like me who are older, who grew up in the 80s, or graduated at least in the 80s, that are fans of the show. So it'll be a good small group kind of thing. But that, I think the book comes out October 19th or something like that. And they didn't even tell me that it was even up on Amazon. Lexham didn't tell me, so
yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah, that's what's next, and that's why the Demons book is getting pushed back.
Boo.
Because they want.
Boo.
I know. It's frustrating.
Oh, why would they do it?
Well, you sound just like I have in like 3 or 4 meetings at Lexham, but they have this thing about putting a certain number of months between my books, and I'm like, look, that if people are interested in this, that are in my audience, they're gonna want to read it anyway. So what does it matter? But
well,
I can't win that
argument. Half. Boo! Oh, I'm so flustered at that.
I know it's just been done for so long. What can I say?
Yeah, it's a
but
shame
that's why, because they moved this big secret project that's no longer a secret in. So the next book that'll appear is the Stranger Things book, and then Demons will follow that after the turn of the year.
And the new season of Stranger
Things. So on that high note.
Yeah, it's coming out, the new season of Stranger Things, July, right? First week of July?
Yeah, they want me to binge watch it on July 4th, that weekend, and then add a chapter to the book. I mean, the book is entirely done. It's all edited. We did these videos, but they want me to add something about the third season. So I'll do that. I mean, that's rough, binge watch, Stranger Things. That'll be real tough.
You're right. But, I feel sorry for you. I'll be watching
two or three times, I'll have to go through it a bunch and take some serious notes and then, crank out a chapter that week. But it's rough.
We'll be looking forward to that book too, but even more so the Demons book. Hopefully they change.
Well, I think they're both, it sounds stupid because I wrote them, but I think they're both really good books. I mean, the Demons book approaches the whole powers of darkness thing in a way that I can honestly say no other book in print does. And that's because of the whole approach of three supernatural rebellions, how that frames the rest of the Bible. Nobody does that.
Well, that makes it worse.
And there's just, I know, but I'm just saying that's really going to be a good book, and I think it'll get a lot of attention just because it's different. And the Stranger Things book is just a good read. I think it'll really be good for, like I said, youth groups and anybody really that's interested in the show. Helping them to think not only about the show in terms of how it, and I don't think it does this intentionally, but how it providentially imitates important themes about, like I said, about the human condition and the solution for the human condition and supernatural stuff. I mean, it does a lot of that you find in the meta narrative of scripture without even knowing it. So I think people who read the book will appreciate both the meta narrative of scripture and the show a little bit more.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Well, no, I'm just saying it makes it worse hearing all that good stuff. We have to wait longer for it, so it makes the wait even worse. But I guess, well, it'll be worth it.
Whenever that happens, just think of Mike fielding another email asking him when the Demons book's coming out. And then it's like, it's just painful to have to tell people the truth. But, you know.
I understand. Well, Mike, we are finally getting across the Red Sea, aren't we? Please tell me we are.
Oh, yeah. We've run into another wall.
We've made
another mess, another quagmire. It's not as bad as chronology, but sort of close. You know, we're going to do this in two parts because the first part today, I'm just going to go through the itinerary, you know, not place by place, because to be honest with you, most of the places in the Exodus itinerary, nobody has any idea where they are. And that contributes to the issue of where's Mount Sinai, because it's going to determine what route they took and where, you know, as to where you end up. But there are certain things in the itinerary that you can know for sure. So we're going to hit those. And there's this big problem of the quote unquote Red Sea, and, you know, related to the crossing, just the description of it, just how it's described. I'm not talking about a problem with the miraculous. If you listen to this podcast for any amount of time, you know I don't have any problem with the miraculous. But there are problems in just how this thing is described that will become evident in our episode today. That part two, I'm going to look at the crossing in an entirely different way, not in terms of geography, you know, like sort of, you know, boots on the ground geography, even though part two will deal with real geography. But I want to get into the issue of how the Exodus plays off of and can be read through the lens of Egyptian cosmic geography, the theological messaging that the whole thing would have conveyed to an Egyptian, which I think is going to be a lot of new stuff for listeners, but it's as you can imagine, it's kind of dense. So we'll do that in a second part, looking at the crossing and the route. But for today, you can basically boil down, to begin with, the fact that the route that the Israelites take, the itinerary, as it were, is drawn primarily from three places in Scripture. And they don't always exactly agree. And that's part of the problem with the route. Some of them are more complete than others. And those three places are Exodus 13. So we're going to pick up a little bit in the prior chapter. Exodus 14, obviously. And then Numbers 33, which is a really important passage for all this. So if you look at Exodus 13, going back to the previous chapter, and you get to verse 17. I'm just going to read verses 17 through 22 because it gets us sort of into the trip, as it were. We read this. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines. So let's just stop there. That's verse 17. Now, that's important because it eliminates the northern route along. They're leaving the delta. Just think of your map of Egypt. At the top, you've got that, you know, the delta with all the tributaries from the Nile flowing into the Mediterranean. Well, you know, there's an eastern border to all that extends all the way down, really to the left tip of the what we know as the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez. But this eliminates the northern route, like following the coastline of the sea. It's just explicitly God says, that's not the way we're going. So God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines. Again, the Philistines were on the coast because the Philistines were descendants of the sea peoples or part of the sea peoples. We know that from Egyptian history and so on and so forth. So that eliminates that. Even though it was near, verse 17 said. So again, it's very clear where we're starting this narrative. The Israelites are leaving the Egyptian delta, you know, the store cities of Pithom and Ramses. Okay, we're in the delta. And so God's like, we're not going to go the closest way. We're not going to go by the land of the Philistines. For God said, this is the rest of verse 17, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. In other words, as soon as there's a conflict, if we go the easy route, they're going to want to turn back. So God says, we're not doing that. Verse 18, but God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. This is, you know, where, for our purposes here, this is where we first get this phrase, Red Sea. We're going to spend a good bit of time on that. And the people of Israel went up from out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. So again, we get this little note that they encounter, or they're going toward the, quote, Red Sea. Red Sea, again, in Hebrew, the full phrase, as it's translated in English Bibles, is Yam Suf, which literally means Sea of Reeds. Now, in part two, when we deal with Egyptian cosmology, there are some scholars who wonder if Suf, remember the Hebrew Bible didn't originally have vowels, and certain consonants did double duty as vowels. And the Vav consonant could be a U vowel, like in Suf, or it could be an O vowel, as in Sof. Some scholars wonder if Yam Sof is in view here, because that's like the sea that ends, or the sea that is at the edge. And if you're talking about Egyptian cosmology, it's basically the sea at the end of the world. You know, this there's a body of water there that marks the border of Egypt, and in the Egyptian mindset, that's like, you know, you're leaving, to borrow a biblical, you're leaving the promised land, the land of the gods, you know, the black land, you know, you're leaving Egypt and you're going off into chaos, you know. So that's going to be part of our discussion in part two about a cosmological reading of this. But for now, we're going to stick with Yam Suf, Sea of Reeds. Again, that's important here because it's going to get us into a classic problem for the Exodus that we'll get to in a moment. And then in verse 20, we actually get sort of movement here. You know, they move on from Succoth and they camp at Etham and on the edge of the wilderness, so on and so forth. Now, a bit of a rabbit trail here, and I'm not going to camp here because I want to focus on the itinerary, as it were. But you probably noticed, and people have, you know, in the past, I'm sure, not just by the virtue of this episode, but verse 21 said the Lord. Okay, the Lord went before them. He's leading the camp of the Israelites in a pillar of cloud, and then at night, a pillar of fire. So it's the divine name. It's Yahweh goes before them. Now, what's interesting about this, in Exodus 14, we read this in verse 19. The angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. Well, wait a minute, I thought it was the Lord who was out front, but here it's the angel of God that's out front. And then you have the pillar of the cloud move as well and stand behind them. So, I mean, it raises this issue. You know, the wording pretty clearly says that the people are led by both the angel, at the very least, both the angel, he and the Lord were going before the Israelites, because they're both put there, and then they both move behind. But then that raises the question, is this the two ways of referring to the same being? Now, we can't necessarily say that here, because there is something visible, the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, so that the presence of God could be in there. And you could also have an anthropomorphic figure, the angel, also out front leading ahead. So you could have the presence of the two powers, as opposed to saying that there was only one thing they could see. Well, evidently, there's two things they can see. They can see the pillar, whether it's cloud and fire, and then the angel, you know, the angel of God was also going before Israel. So this is another interesting passage when you get to the two powers in heaven stuff, because very clearly you've got at least two figures. You can't necessarily say that they're only looking at one thing. They're probably looking at two, but one of them is an anthropomorphized Yahweh, okay, the angel of God, because he's interchanged positionally with the presence of the Lord himself. So again, I'm not going to camp on this, just a passing note there, because I want to focus on itinerary stuff. So as far as the steps, we're going to utilize Numbers 33, and we just read a few verses in chapter 13. We hit you know, chapter 14. So Exodus 14 sort of presupposes, you know, the context of Exodus 13, 20. Exodus 13, 20 said they moved from Succoth and they encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And so Exodus 14 kind of picks up from that point. The chapter begins this way. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal or Baal Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. You know, for Pharaoh will say to the people of Israel, they're wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. The Israelites did so. So we get, again, a little bit more in terms of geographical points. We have this Pi Hahiroth place, whatever that is. We've got Migdol. We've got Baal Zephon. So if we take that in conjunction with Exodus 13, 20, Succoth and Etham, we're beginning to have a sort of a station-by-station, you know, commentary. But if we go to Numbers 33, specifically Numbers 33, 5, we actually get another place from which the journey actually begins. It doesn't begin at Succoth. Succoth's going to come. If you read Numbers 33, 5, it says, so the people of Israel set out from Ramses and camped at Succoth. And then they leave Succoth, and then they camp at Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. That's Numbers 33, 5, and 6. So it sounds exactly like what we read in Exodus 13 and Exodus, you know, we're leading to Exodus 14. I might as well throw in Numbers 33, 7 here. I'll just read 5 through 7 here. So the people of Israel set out from Ramses. That's where they actually begin. And again, that makes sense because of the Pithom and Ramses thing from Exodus 1:11. And they camped at Succoth. And they set out from Succoth and camped at Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. And they set out from Etham, and they turned back to Pi Hahiroth, which is east of Baal Zephon, and they camped before Migdol. So we get all the place names that we've already encountered in Exodus 13 and 14, but we get this the actual starting point here in Numbers 33, verse 5. So the order that we have here is Ramses, that city, that place, Succoth, Etham, and then we get this Pi Hahiroth, Baal Zephon, and Migdol. So this is our little concatenation of place names that we have to sort of start with. So they sound a lot like each other. And if you go back to Exodus 13, just think about this. I want to set something in Numbers 33 up. Exodus 13 sounded like, okay, we're on our way. We're not going north. We're going to leave Succoth. We're going to camp at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. The Lord's leading us. And then we hit verse or chapter 14, and he said, the Lord says, tell the people of Israel to turn back and camp in front of Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, and in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp by it, facing the sea. For Pharaoh will say to the people, hey, they're wandering around the land. The wilderness has shut them in. You know, Pharaoh's like, I love the line from the Ten Commandments where Yul Brynner, you know, Pharaoh says, looks at the situation and he sees the Israelites with the sea to their back. And he says, the God of Israel is a poor general. Yeah, he doesn't really need to worry too much about whether he graduated from West Point or not. You know, I just love the line because Pharaoh's going to basically eat the words pretty quickly. But the sense you get here as we start chapter 14 is that this is a precursor. These place names are an immediate precursor to the crossing of the sea. Okay, that's just a face value, you know, sort of reading of it. I mean, it just sounds that way. And I think that's pretty transparent. You know, tell the people of Israel, turn back, camp by Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea in front of Baal Zephon. You shall camp facing it by the sea. Now, if you keep reading in Exodus 14, let's just read verses 5 through 18, that observation that these places, these, again, this concatenation of place names, is leading up to the moment of the crossing, because that's basically what happens here. So Exodus 14, verse 5, and again, just bear with me. There's a point to doing it, rehearsing all this. Verse 5 says, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, what is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot, took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and he overtook them, where? Encamped by the sea. Now, you'll notice in chapter 14, we have now three references to the sea. None of them say Red Sea. The phrase Red Sea never occurs in chapter 14. It does in 13, and it will in 15, but it doesn't occur in chapter 14. So hold on to that little factoid, because you can see again, this is where the conflict and the climax is going to happen here. So he overtook them and camped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon, which is exactly where we read earlier that they were camped. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes. This is verse 10. And behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians," which is kind of new information. "For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in this wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." It's a nice way of saying, just shut up. God's got this. Verse 15, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Why do you cry to me?'" So again, you know, Moses is evidently praying about this thing. "Lord, what are we going to do? Tell the people of Israel to go forward." Like, say what? "Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea." Notice the references to the sea, the sea, the sea. It's never the Red Sea. "That the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground, and I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." And then it's at this point that the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, which is basically the God slot before, moves and goes behind them. And then the pillar moves as well. Okay, and it lit up, you know, the pillar of fire at night, so on and so forth. And then in verse 21, Moses stretches out his hand over the sea. "The Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land." Again, sea, sea, sea. "And the waters were divided. The people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of the fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, 'Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back on the Egyptians upon their chariots and upon their horsemen.'" And so, you know, Moses does that. And again, the rest of the story, we know. The waters return, you know, drowns the Egyptians. And at the end here, the people feared the Lord. They believed in the Lord, his servant Moses. Now, what's the big deal about the vocabulary? The sea. Okay, just hold on to that. As we read that story, think back to the way it began. Okay? Think back to the way it began. They leave Ramses. They leave Sukkot then. That was stop number two. They go from Sukkot to Etham. And then from Etham, God says, you know, tell the people of Israel to turn back and camp in front of Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. And then that's when the crisis happens and the deliverance happens. So this sea is right there somewhere where these places are, Pi-Hahiroth, Migdol, and Baal Zephon. Okay, that's where this happens. Now let's go to Numbers 33 and listen carefully, and I think you're going to detect a problem here. Numbers 33, beginning in verse 7. "And they set out from Etham and turned back to Pi-Hahiroth, which is east of Baal Zephon. And they camped before Migdol. And they set out from before Hahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness, And they went a 3 days journey in the wilderness of Etham and camped at Marah. And they set out from Marah and came to Elim. At Elim, there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. And they camped there. And they set out from Elim, and camped by the Red Sea. Did you catch that? The sea that they passed through happens before they camp by the Red Sea. So how is it that we talk about the Israelites passing through the Red Sea? They passed through something else before they ever got there. You know, this is again, something that scholars and many other people have noticed. It's like, how in the world? And it really gets weird when you look at the vocabulary across chapters 13, 14, and 15. In chapter 13, verse 18, there is the phrase Red Sea. It's a generic reference. I'll read it to you again. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea, toward the Yam Suf. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. This is kind of generic. It just says God led the people toward the Red Sea. And so it doesn't really capture the whole itinerary in one verse. It's sort of a catch-all reference, like kind of designating where they're going to wind up. But, you know, it might be useful in light of how we're going to try to unravel this. In chapter 14, the term Yam Suf, Red Sea, is never used. You have verse 2, verse 9, verse 16, verse 21, verse 23. Again, that's not all of them. It's just Yam, the sea. But when you get to chapter 15, both of those terms are used, and one time they're used in the same verse in parallel. In other words, the crossing for chapter 15 was the crossing in the midst of the sea and in the midst of the Yam Suf, in the midst of the Yam and the midst of the Yam Suf. And it's like, how can that be? Because in Numbers 33, they pass through the midst of the sea, Yam, and then they go days before they camp by the Red Sea, the Yam Suf. In Exodus 15, 4 specifically, that's sort of the key text in chapter 15. It uses both Yam and Yam Suf for what was crossed. Let me read it to you. Pharaoh's chariots and his host, he, God, cast into the sea, Yam, and his chosen officers were sunk in the Red Sea, Yam Suf. So it's very evident that both terms are referring to the same event in the same place. But yet, Numbers 33 seems to separate them by days. Like, how does that work? What body of water did the Israelites cross, if we're reading Numbers 33, if it wasn't the Red Sea? But then, how could it not be the Red Sea if Exodus 15 uses that term in parallel to just the sea? So we kind of have a double conundrum here. How can they be separate but the same? And how can they be different geographical places? Because in Numbers, they're separated by days, but still be the same. So how can they cross something, you know, that it's just weird. Like, it looks like there are two places at one time, but they're all still the same. You know, again, people have noticed this, and it's become kind of a classic problem for this passage, and it contributes to, if that's the right word, makes worse would be a better word, but it contributes to the problem of, after whatever it is they crossed, which way are they going? Because you first have to settle the crossing problem and have it somehow be both the Red Sea, but yet not the Red Sea. And then, you know, once they're out, God's going to tell them, you know, we're going to read about them turning. You know, like what, which way do they turn? Because that's going to dictate the route, and that's going to dictate what you think about Sinai, the destination. So all these problems sort of, again, you know, are mixed together, which, again, I'm hoping you're seeing is again, why this is a struggle for interpreters to figure out, and nobody has it figured out. But, you know, where'd they go? Which way'd they take? Where'd they end up? What's Sinai? What's the Red Sea? What's this other sea? I mean, all these questions that just go into a straightforward reading of the passages, the three main passages anyway, that talk about the journey. Like, what in the world's going on? Now, Hoffmeyer, James Hoffmeyer, has spent a good deal of effort resolving the problem of the Yam Suf. That's kind of how it's known to scholars, the problem of the Yam Suf, the problem of the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds. You know, which is another thing. If it's the Sea of Reeds, it can't be salt water because reeds don't, you know, grow in salt. I mean, what's going on here? So I'm going to abbreviate Hoffmeyer's treatment here because I think he really does good work here. This is from his, if you want the book with all the details, and it's quite detailed. His book, Israel in Egypt, which I have referenced before in other episodes. For those of you who, you know, this is the book I always recommend when I get emails like, you know, either asking genuinely or trying to make it sound like they know something when they really don't. But, the Bible's not historical. There's no evidence, you know, that the Exodus narratives, you know, there's like no supporting evidence to, you know, from Egypt that makes these at all, you know, possible, blah, blah. Yeah, right. There's only like 200 pages of it here. Read that if you're really interested. Again, Hoffmeyer is an Egyptologist. You know, there's a lot of cross-fertilization in Exodus with Egyptological material. Yeah, you don't have the Egyptian version of this event, but basically everything about the event you can find in Egyptian literature somewhere. And of course, archaeological remains. So again, just as a word to those of you who might be, I guess, be apologetics minded, you know, whenever you hear this, try not to laugh, but you know, direct people to this book, Israel in Egypt. And he also has one, Hoffmeyer has one, I think it's called Israel in Sinai or something like that, where you get more of it. But this is the book, you know, for the Exodus. So I'm gonna abbreviate how Hoffmeyer proposes that we resolve this. And I'm going to refer to some things that we will have on the episode webpage, again, to help you look. Basically, most of it's going to be pictorial, pictures that you can look at later if you're listening now in a car or something like that. You can go look at them later. But in his book, Israel in Egypt, he gets into this in a lot of detail. Now, his discussion is primarily about the literal geography here. We haven't even gotten to the cosmic geography stuff. He has a little bit in his book on that, but we're going to get into that in a lot more detail next week. So the Yam Suf problem, Hoffmeyer notes that it should be obvious, and I would say it should be obvious from the little we've read, that the crossing of the sea is at Egypt's eastern border. I mean, that much we know. We've hit the landmarks, Ramses, Sukkot, Etham, and then from Etham, they set out, they turn back, important phrase, they turn back to Pi Hahirot. We'll find out what that is in a moment, which is east of Baal Zephon, and they camp before Migdal. So that those names do tell us some important things. All of these places are known to be on or immediately adjacent to Egypt's eastern border, the eastern border of Egypt. Now that much is proof positive that the crossing of whatever body of water this is was nowhere near Eilat, the Gulf of Aqaba, and Midian. It is nowhere near that. It's on Egypt's eastern border. The crossing basically occurs when they're getting out of Egypt. You know, basically right at the beginning of the whole trip. And to be fair, those who argue that Sinai, you know, Mount Sinai, is east of the Gulf of Aqaba in Midian somewhere, they don't necessarily tie that view of Sinai to a specific place of the crossing of the Red Sea, but some do. But just so that you understand, you know, if someone, you know, holds to a Mount Sinai and Midian, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have the Red Sea crossing at the right prong of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba. The left prong is the Gulf of Suez, okay? Where the crossing actually happened, and again, the geography itself tells us we can know this with absolute certainty. The crossing occurred on Egypt's eastern border. That's where these places are, and they are all known. Okay? Anyone on the internet or anywhere else that tells you that the Israelites crossed anywhere in the right prong of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba, that like the crossing at Nuweiba or some other such crossing to get the Israelites into Midian from Mount Sinai, you can safely ignore any crossing view of the right prong. It completely ignores everything that is known about these place names. Again, that doesn't mean that you've argued against Mount Sinai in Midian. There are other problems with that, as we've talked about. But there are some who tie these two things together. I mentioned the Nueva crossing. You know, that was associated with, I believe, Ron Wyatt. And you know, it's on the internet. I mean, if you Google this, you're going to run into this view. This view textually is not possible because of the geographical names. So any view of the crossing on the right prong of the Red Sea is just not correct. I mean, I don't waste your time even thinking about it. You know, and you're going to get some, you know, goofy archaeology that tries to prove this and that. Look, all you need to do is go read the itinerary and look up these place names in academic sources, and you're going to find out they're all known and they're all on Egypt's eastern border. So we're done with that. Let's go back to the actual Yam Suf problem. Hofmeyr takes Exodus 15:4, where both Yam and Yam Suf are used in parallelism, to describe the body of water that was crossed. Now, his hypothesis, you know, listen to this carefully. His hypothesis is that what is being described as a body of water, with the word Yam, sea in English translations, that body, whatever that was, in ancient times was connected to what we know as the Red Sea, and what the biblical writers would call Yam Suf. If you can picture in your mind, and again, I have maps on the episode page, you know, that you can look at. If you can picture in mind the two forks of the Red Sea, the left fork, the Gulf of Suez, it points, as it were, upward toward the eastern border of Egypt's delta region. In ancient times, there were a string of lakes extending from that tip of the Gulf of Suez northward to form, again, part of like a border line of Egypt. And they were connected. They were either connected naturally or they were connected by a series of canals. We're going to come back to the canal thing because that's going to become important. Therefore, Hofmeyr argues, Israel could cross one of these bodies of water. Again, there are just a bunch of them dotted upward from the tip of the Gulf of Suez all the way into the delta. Egypt could cross one of these lakes. They were essentially lakes. And the word Yam can refer to any body of water, even a river, you know, in the Old Testament. When Israel crossed one of those lakes, they technically, to the mind of an ancient person, would also be crossing the Red Sea, because all of those things are connected to the Red Sea. They're not the Red Sea proper, but they are nevertheless tethered to it by a series of waterways. So in this view, sea and Red Sea are one and the same, but they're also different. The sea is just one of the smaller bodies of water connected to the left tip of what we know as the Red Sea. The left tip is the Gulf of Suez. Now, Hofmeyr, to articulate this and defend it, draws heavily on the work of geophysical surveys that for him, and I'll say, you know, just tell you, for me as well, I think this is how this needs to be thought of. I think Hofmeyr does really good work here. You know, these surveys for him and for me explain references in a variety of ancient sources to a string of lakes that at various times in Egyptian history were connected by canals. You know, this is modern geophysical surveys have detected these things even thousands of years after they're dried up. You can actually see them in satellite photography. And so there's an important article that Hofmeyr draws on, and it's by Amihai Sneh, that's S-N-E-H, Tuvia Weisbrod, and Itamar Perot. And the article is entitled Evidence for an Ancient Egyptian Frontier Canal. It's an important description, by the way, Frontier Canal. This is part of the border. Evidence for an Ancient Egyptian Frontier Canal, the remnants of an artificial waterway discovered in the northeastern Nile Delta, may have formed part of the barrier called the Shore of Egypt in ancient texts. It's a long title. It's from American Scientists, number 63, volume 63, number 5. This is 1975, September, October 1975. Now, I've posted pictures from this article in a PDF on the episode page. I can't post the whole article. It's not publicly accessible. Again, I can put it in the protected folder, but I've at least put pictures, a couple of the relevant pictures in the article that will help you see what the satellite photographs show. So this 1975 article referenced by Hofmeyr, again, is really an important piece of work. Now, there's another article on this that can also get you some good pictures that's much later. Hofmeyr's book was written after that first article I mentioned, but before this one, the second article. And the second article is publicly accessible. So we'll have a link to this on the episode webpage. And that's by John Cooper, Egypt's Nile, Red Sea Canals, subtitle Chronology, Location, Seasonality, and Function. This is pages 195 to 209 in a book called Connected Hinterlands, Proceedings of the Red Sea Project, Volume 4, held at the University of Southampton in September 2008. It's part of the Bar International series and part of the Society for Arabian Studies monograph series. But this chapter is publicly accessible, so we'll have a link there. Now, again, to summarize all that, what you have and what Hofmeyr is going to defend, again, I think he does a good job of it. I think this is the answer to the Amsuf problem, is that you've got the Gulf of Suez, the left tip, what we think of as the left tip of the Red Sea. But extending from that, you have a series of lakes that are connected, again, by canals. So Israel crossed one of those bodies of water, one of those lakes, and then they're going to turn, and then they're going to camp somewhere by the actual Red Sea. Okay, so you can have crossing the sea before you get to the Red Sea. This is how you approach it. So I'm going to read a little bit from Hofmeyr. He says this. In the early 1970s, a team of scientists of the Geological Survey of Israel, while working in the Sinai Peninsula during Israel's occupation of the territory east of the Suez Canal, discovered the remains of what they believed was a canal that ran along Egypt's border with the Sinai. Aerial photography and on-site study led to this identification by the leaders of the team, Amihai Sneh and Tuvia Weisbrod. The width of this canal constantly measures 70 meters at the top and was probably tapered toward the bottom where it was thought to be around 20 meters wide. So that's a pretty substantial canal. This makes it wider than the Suez Canal when cut in 1873. The recently discovered channel is calculated to be 2 or 3 meters deep. So what's left of this, you know, it dries up and it's going to fill up with sand, but it's still detectable, again, with satellite, you know, photography. What's left of it isn't very deep, but it's there. Back to Hofmeyr. Hofmeyr writes, the Israeli geologists associated with the newly discovered canal with the one shown on a relief, or they associated the newly discovered canal with one shown on a relief of Seti I. Again, Seti I, circa 1300 BC. Again, Hofmeyr's a late dater, but this doesn't really factor into early or late date. It's just a canal. The canal is actually much older than either of the dates. So the geologists thought, hey, you know, here we got this canal. And they remembered or found that there's a reference to a canal on Egypt's border in one of the inscriptions of Seti I at the Karnak Temple in Thebes. Hofmeyr writes, in the midst of the waterway of that inscription, that relief, that drawing, in the midst of the waterway, a hieroglyphic label reads Ta Denit. Sir Alan Gardner commented on this scene in 1920 and noted that the building complex depicted on the relief, again, on the piece of art, to the left of the canal is labeled Ketem En Charu, which is translated the Fortress of Charu. Concurrently, the earliest reference to this fort by this name is in the Animals of Thutmose III. The name of the canal was Ta Denit, clearly meaning, quote, the dividing waters, and so called because they sundered Egypt from the desert. Weisbrod and Sneh believe that the history of the canal might go back to the 12th dynasty because of the references concerning Sinue's journey back from Palestine by boat to Ijtawi, the capital at the time. And then Hofmeyr goes into the text and talks about, you know, commentary on it. Hofmeyr, you know, winds up his discussion by asking this on page 169 of his book. If indeed a canal existed along Egypt's border with Sinai during the New Kingdom, and the evidence does support this view, it seems logical to conclude that it would have been an impediment to the Israelites in their departure from Egypt. Thus, it must be asked, is there any reference or allusion to this canal in the Exodus narratives? Again, if they're leaving Ramses and then Sukkot and Etham, I mean, they should be running into this waterway and the lakes that it connects. So is there any reference to that? And Hofmeyr thinks the answer to this question is, you betcha, yes. He writes, the itinerary of the departing Hebrews from Egypt includes Pi-ha-hirot in Exodus 14:2 and Numbers 33:7. Scholars have long attempted to find an Egyptian etymology, Egyptian source origin, for Pi-ha-hirot because of the initial element Pi, which in Egyptian would be per, That element is suggestive of Egyptian toponyms, Egyptian place names such as P. Ramses, Pithom, and P. Besethet, just to name a few. There's a lot of these. So when scholars, let me stop there, when scholars saw P. Hachirot, they thought, this is probably a term that comes from Egyptian. Hoffmeyer proceeds to discuss why an Egyptian etymology fails, and it does, basically because of what comes after the P, that is Hachirot, which does not conform well to Egyptian for linguistic reasons. Again, if you've had Hebrew, when I say Hachirot, you should be thinking definite article plus a feminine plural. It's just, this is a Hebrew term. This is a Semitic term. So I don't, you know, again, I'm amazed that they kept looking in Egypt for as long as they did, and it's basically because of the P-I word that came in front of it. But basically, there aren't any seasoned, trained Egyptologists now who would disagree with Hoffmeyer that says, look, this is not an Egyptian term. Everybody more or less agrees with that now. There really aren't any good equivalents. And again, if you know Hebrew, Hachirot should just scream Hebrew to you, just a normal, you know, feminine plural noun. So Hoffmeyer goes on to reference the work of Albright here back in 1948, who suggested, and again, I think this is pretty clear, he suggested a meaning for P. Hachirot as this, the mouth of the canals. P is mouth, Hirot, you know, it's canals. Okay, that's what it is. Hoffmeyer proceeds to link the phrase with the canals that connect various bodies of water, lakes, from the tip of the Gulf of Suez that form part of Egyptian's eastern border. This makes a lot of sense. It explains the dual reference to the sea, again, one of these bodies of water, and then the Red Sea later on, how they can be the same but yet different. And in so doing, it explains why both terms are used interchangeably for the body of water through which is passed. Yes, you're crossing a lake. Okay, I got it. But it's part of the Red Sea, kind of technically, because it's joined by all these canals. I mean, this is how they would have thought about it. So if you go back to the itinerary, you've got Ramses, Sukkot, Etham. Then they set out from Etham, turned back to Pi Hachirot, which is east of Baal Zephon, and they camped before Migdal. Now the text here speaks of a turning back after leaving Etham to Pi Hachirot, the mouth of the canal. So they set out, you know, they're going, and then and for some reason, God directs them to turn in a certain direction so that they're at this water border, okay? And we know what the purpose is. God knows that Pharaoh's going to look at this and snicker, and like Yul Brynner say, the God of Israel is a poor general. Because God is going to get glory over Pharaoh. I don't need to be a good general, okay? I'm God. You know, this is a setup. The whole thing is a setup. You know, and then they pass through, again, one of these bodies of water, they pass through the sea, and then they're going to turn, and they're going to go for a few days, and they're going to hit this place and that place, and eventually they're going to camp by the Red Sea. So what we know for sure is that the crossing is at one of these lakes, and there are a number of candidates. You know, Hoffmeyer, in his book, he goes through all the candidates, you know, Lake Timsah, Lake Bela, you know, there's three or four of these. You know, and he's like anybody else, you know, he has his favorite and whatnot, but that isn't important. What they cross, even the canal. I mean, if you look back at the canal, I mean, the measurements of the canal, lots of people would have drowned just in the canal. I mean, this is a meaningful, a serious crossing. It has to be divided. You don't just walk across it like you're going across a sandbar or something. This is a serious obstacle. It's a lethal obstacle because the waters are going to part. The Egyptians are going to go down in there, and then they're going to get drowned when God closes the thing up. But it's not the Red Sea proper. It's one of these extension bodies of water. So we have the crossing, and then we run into some questions. Okay, Numbers 33:8. They set out from before Hachirot and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness. You have to ask, well, what direction are they going? What direction are they going? They get through the barrier, pass through the midst of the sea into the wilderness. So now they're out in the desert. They went a 3 days journey into the wilderness of Etham and camped at Marah. They set out from Marah and came to Elim. At Elim, there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there. And they set out from Elim and camped by the Red Sea. Now, here's the question. Think about your map again. You got the two prongs of the Red Sea, as we know it, as we refer to it now. They're crossing some body of water that extends from the left one, the Gulf of Suez. They get through, the Egyptians are drowned, now they're out in the wilderness. do they turn south or do they go more or less straight across the wilderness? And the answer is nobody knows. If you believe in the traditional site of Mount Sinai, which is way, way south, Jebel Musa, you're going to say, oh, they must have turned south. If you don't believe that that's where Mount Sinai is, you're going to say, oh, they must have just gone straight across. Because after all, there are caravan trails there. They could follow a caravan trail. And there are caravan trails there. There have been since, you know, thousands of years, you know. See, that's the question. Once you get past the crossing, where are they going? Because from this point on, while the early place names are known with certainty, none of what follows is known with certainty. And frankly, there's only really even a guess at one or two of them. And it's nothing more than a guess. So here we are again. You know, how do we take this information and know where they end up? Now, Levine's, just to illustrate this for you, Levine's commentary on Numbers 33, this is Baruch Levine in his Anchor Bible series. It's not just Mike saying, nobody knows where in the world these things are. This is Levine's commentary. He says, from Etham, Pithom, at the beginning, the Israelites turn back to Pi-Hahirot. Again, this is the setup. God's putting them in an impossible situation so that he can show Pharaoh who's God. Okay, they turn back to Pi-Hahirot, which is facing Baal Zephon and camping before Migdal. None of these, three toponyms has been positively identified, but the name Migdal means watchtower fortress, and that's West Semitic rather than Egyptian. In context, it's certainly located in the Egyptian Delta region. The name Migdal appears once in the El Amarna letters, but again, we don't know exactly where this particular tower was. As for Pi-Hahirot, and this is the key, it is likewise specifically unidentified, like we don't know exactly where in the network of canals they crossed, but it's somewhere in the eastern Delta region, and it appears to represent a Hebraized rendering of an original Akkadian designation. I didn't mention the Akkadian equivalent, but he's correct. Pi-Hiritu, the mouth of the canals. So he's saying, look, we don't know exactly where, but all these places are in the Egyptian Delta, the eastern border of the Egyptian Delta. Baal Zephon, also unidentified, again, as with precision, was known, a well-known Syro-Canaanite deity, or Baal, whose cult was imported into Egypt. At least three Baal Zephon sanctuaries have been found in northern Egypt, in Memphis, Toponese, and Mount Cassius as Ras Kasrun. According to Betok, who's the guy who excavated Avaris, the Pithom and Ramses location, the site associated with that, according to Betok, a temple at Tel El Daba, just south of Kantir, it was dedicated to Baal. Again, this is all in the Eastern Delta. All of it. He takes note of a place called Migdal. This is Betok again. There's a place called Migdal up there, located near Wadi Tumilat, which is mentioned in Cairo Papyrus 31.169, blah, 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 blah. And Levine says this. This all indicates a location in the Eastern Delta area. Again, that's what we know for sure. There is no crossing anywhere except in the Eastern Delta border. That's why I'm saying if you go out on the internet and I want to learn about the crossing of the Red Sea, if you read anything else but somewhere on Egypt's Eastern Delta border region, it's wrong. It just is. He goes in further into Numbers 33 and says, Marah, Levine starts talking about Marah. He postulates a place where the water is, quote, brackish, because Marah means bitter, and says, some have suggested Marah is Ayin Havara, 47 miles south of Suez. Well, you know why they're picking that location? Because it's south. And the traditional view of Sinai is that it's south of where they crossed. That's the only reason. And then all of the other sites, Dofka, Alush, Rephidim, and Sinai that show up in Numbers 33, Levine says, we don't know where they are. So what you have is after the crossing, you have a situation where the place names in any view, not just a view you like or don't like, but in any view, they are all speculation. And again, I'm hoping you see how it matters once they break through, once God brings them through. You got two choices. And again, I have a map on the episode website for this. And where people think they went, where is directly related to where people, let me say it this way. where people think or try to argue, let's put it that way, that's even better, where people try to argue these other place names are in Numbers 33 depends entirely on where they think Sinai is. And most people will say, well, Sinai's down there in near St. Catherine's Monastery, Jebel Musa, you know, way, way, way down there between the forks. So it's obvious, quote unquote, obvious that we should expect to find these places moving southward after the crossing. Well, it's actually not obvious because you're letting one preconceived conclusion dictate your methodology and your conclusions for the other stuff. But the alternative views do the same thing. You have to realize that everybody's in the same boat. Some people are going to, you know, say, well, Har Karkom is Mount Sinai. Again, and because that's Mount Sinai, then they went directly across. Or they're going to say, oh, Mount Sinai is somewhere, you know, in that Edom, you know, border with Midian area, like we talked about in earlier episodes. So if you like that view, you're going to take them straight across. If you think Mount Sinai is east of the Gulf of Aqaba over in Midian proper, you're going to take them straight across. That's what you're going to do. Your view of the location of Mount Sinai will dictate where you look for these place names and how to defend and try to defend certain sites as being these places. But the reality is nobody knows. So that's the unfortunate situation. But again, all of that is really dealing with what do we do with the toponyms, you know, the actual geography here. Next time in part two, what I want to do is backtrack to some of these things, you know, the phrase Yam Suf, see at the end, the whole concept of Egypt. When you leave Egypt, you go into the wilderness, and it's chaos, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, the Egyptians thought this way too. They thought their land was the best land. You know, we're the top people of civilization. The gods love us, you know, blah, 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 blah. Everywhere else is bad and you know, inferior, and it's not Egyptian. Okay. So if you're looking at it that way, as an Egyptian, there are going to be certain things about the narrative and about some of these locations that are going to speak theology to you. They are going to be religious, theological, polemic statements because, again, of the worldview that's involved. So next time we're going to devote a second episode to the crossing and again, some of this location, but try to take a different angle for it, Egyptian cosmology. And I think you'll find it interesting. I don't, you know, I'm not saying that you have to pick between a cosmological interpretation of the itinerary and the crossing or a historical one. You don't. It's a both and, not an either or. It's just different ways of looking at the same, you know, data points.
All right, Mike, we'll be looking forward to part two and I guess your free time too. Let us know what you do with yourself after your job. You know, I'd love to know what's your first lazy day or thing you do for yourself. Like, are you going to take just?
Oh, I can't really even fathom that because I don't. To me, it's like I'm unleashed now.
Yeah. Well, take a nap.
So I'm not gonna spend the time you know eating Kit Kats on the sofa or something like, as much as I would enjoy that. But no, we'll come up with something to do. Trust me. Okay, this is going to sound sad. It might make somebody cry or laugh. But I have a list of 46 things that I want to do, like in the first month.
Are they in order? Are they ranked? Of importance?
They're not. Well, some of them are ranked. They're
give us three things.
They're like first 2 weeks, and then everything else. You know, it's just. Yeah. I know it's kind of sad, but well,
give us at least one thing on the list. Give us one thing on the list.
One thing on the list is to tag. See, I have I don't have all of them because this is part of the task. I'm probably 20 hours away from having all of my physical books and all of the books I have on PDF and all of the books I have in Logos in a database. So I know everything I actually have. So I don't accidentally buy something I already have. And then once that's in there, I want to tag them just like I did for the Divine Council bibliography so that I know, you know, hey, is there a book on this or this passage? I can just put the tag in there. There it is. Nice. So I can search, you know, the titles and the tags in my library. That's a really geeky kind of thing to do. But once you have it done, it's a huge time saver.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Mike. Well, that sounds good. Well, myself, I'm just going to take a nap. So
Well, I'm going to let Maury sit on my lap while I do that.
All right. Sounds good. All right, Mike. Well, enjoy the summer and We will be looking forward to part two next week. And with that, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.